The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. And today is our last reading from the July-August 2022 Smithsonian. We've had five Wednesdays this month, and I'm delighted to have been here for all five. The Long Haul by Stephen Mallon, photography, and Terence Monomany. Americans' fascination with trains is fast-tracked in this photographer's study of passing freight. Railroads, trains are such magnificent objects, we commonly mistake them for destiny, said E.B. White, a great philosopher. Is there any disputing the fact that Americans can get a little obsessed by trains? From a Tots crayon red caboose to the self-described train nerd's bucket list, a.k.a. Railroad's Denali Star, check, Grand Canyon Railway, yep, Napa Valley Wine Train, cheers, the romance of the rails exerts a pull only slightly less powerful than GE's legendary 8,500 horsepower Big Blow locomotive. Stephen Mallon, a photographer in the Hudson Valley of New York, has long been in the thrall of trains, among other large machines. Over the last 4 years, as work or pleasure set him in motion across the United States, he sought out locales, scenic, industrial, rural, urban, where he could do his own special train spotting. The result is a series of striking portraits of freight cars and locomotives. He created each one as a train rolled by. Back in his studio, he cropped the picture to isolate one car, composing it as if it were a still life. The approach might sound fanciful, but, as Mallon says, every passing train is unique, a never-seen-before combination of cars, place, and time. This project is never going to be repeatable, Mallon says, of the visual novelty. He's also cognizant that some carriers seem headed for the end of the line. For now, some 1.7 million freight cars and locomotives are at large in the United States, and what marvelous contraptions they are, as you can see through Mallon's lens. Cars designed just to transport automobiles, or chemicals, or gravel, or what have you. The immensity, power, and speed of these thundering enterprise are all thrilling. It's also gratifying to think about these great steel conveyances hauling stuff across the land and to be reminded that, yes, we are connected. And we have a double-page spread of a center-beam flat car. This specialized platform is carrying lumber through Teaneck, New Jersey. Construction materials made up about 12% of the 3 million carloads of freight hauled each year. Some travel quite a vast distance. There is some 140,000 miles of railroad track available to freight trains in the United States today. And the picture of the flat car, it's just loaded with boards. And then down below is another one just as large and isolated, filled with pipe. Flatbed. This car carries pipes through upstate New York, not far from the photographer's home. Part of the project's appeal for Mallon was the element of surprise. He never knew in advance exactly what was coming down the line. But what he could count on was that each encounter would be a singular experience. Next page, a rusty green flat car, not a flat car, but a box car. And some of its panels are missing so that you can see the mountains on the other side of it. Gondola. People often mark freight cars with graffiti, including this gondola near the Nevada-Utah border. Malin Squires Google Maps and Railfan Forums to find public locations where he could view trains in motion. I wanted a project that I could shoot on my own terms, he says. And down below, a center beam flat car, the sprawling landscapes and pinpoint accuracy of Malin's images sometimes belie the substantial scale of his subjects. This center beam flat car is around 70 feet long and specially designed to transport up to 100 tons of lumber. Fresh tracks at the bottom of the frame show just how close the photographer was able to get. Next page, a rail car with graffiti. The traditional enclosed car, this one was sighted in Jacksonville, Florida, could be carrying consumer goods such as paper. Boxcars are not as common as they used to be. They require more work to load and unload than other platforms, and also have been largely supplanted by globe-trotting containers, which are hoisted from cargo ships onto specialized rail cars. And below is the ubiquitous red caboose. And photographing passing freight was a mostly solo affair for Malin, involving hours-long stakeouts with only a book for company. Here, the solitude is interrupted by a crewman who seems to be waving from the rear of the caboose. Though today's electronic devices perform tasks that brakemen once did, the ultimate car still sometimes serves as an office, workshop, or lounge. This one, it looks like it's been recently painted. And a little sideline here of Stephen Malin. Specializing in photography of construction sites and machinery, Stephen Malin has exhibited work widely, including shows at the New York Transit Museum and the East River Ferry. Reporting research for our accompanying text was done by Teddy Brokaw. Up next, the cutting edge. Roughly 2 million years ago, simple stone tools sparked a revolution in the way humans lived. On the Homa Peninsula in southwestern Kenya, east of Lake Victoria, lies an archaeological site where researchers have found some of humanity's oldest tools. These implements, known to experts as Oldwan, named after the Olduvai Gorge, an archaeologically rich site near Tanzania, were shaped by our human ancestors into an impressive variety of wedges and hammers between 2.6 million and 1.6 million years ago, at the very start of the Stone Age. Studying this breakthrough technology, researchers have gained new insights into this lower Paleolithic phase of human evolution. Long before widespread agriculture, the development of Oldwan led to better-fed, smarter hominins and may well have enabled these largely itinerant early humans to begin establishing a sense of home. The site, known as Kanjira South, was established in 1987 by the National Museum of Kenya in collaboration with the Smithsonian's Human Origins Program, whose founding director, the paleoanthropologist Richard Potts, began excavations that summer. Kenyans worked alongside U.S.-educated archaeologists, including Thomas Plummer, then a doctoral student at Yale University, whom Potts met while teaching there. According to Potts, it was Plummer who suggested the group would find far greater archaeological riches if they focused their attention around 800 feet to the south. And, sure enough, Potts and Plummer were soon unearthed by a mesmerizing stone tool, approximately 2 million years old, on loan from the Kenyan government since 2011. This stone, known as the Kenjira tool, after the site where it lay buried, is the oldest human-made object in any Smithsonian collection. And there's a picture here with what just looks like a rock to me. The stone appears well used, the scars on its numerous edges indicating serious wear and tear. The business sides of the tool are marked by flakes, the result of a chipping process that created serrated edges sharp enough for cutting. The handle side, meanwhile, is flat and smooth. It's easy to imagine this rock as it was before hominins instrumentalized it, a flat, rounded stone. While visitors to the Smithsonian will not get a chance to hold the tool, anyone can see it fits nicely in one's hands. According to Potts, the implement offers an easy grip and weighs about half a pound. Also notable is the reddish iron color on the 12 flakes of the sharp end. Though such a color typically points to a volcanic origin, and though hominins often used volcanic rocks for tools, geological analysis indicates that the Kenjira stone is actually a quartz-like rock, non-volcanic. Smithsonian archaeologists surmise it may have been pulled from the ground 5 or 6 miles away from Kenjira South. Most likely, though, hominins struck and used the Kenjira tool at various other locations before it found its final resting place. To make a sharp tool such as the Kenjira stone, a hominin would use a hammer stone to serrate the new tool, creating sharp edges capable of cutting different materials, from animal flesh to vegetation to wood. The consequences of our ancestors innovating the sharper tools of the Oldowan is that all sorts of food in the African savanna, from the grasslands to the wetlands, became newly available. Hominins could suddenly cut and prepare tubers, which entered their diet in this period, and meat became more regular fare as hominins scavenged antelopes and other prey from larger predators such as lions. Researchers at Kenjira South have discovered a variety of animal bones dating to the same period, scarred by stone tools, some of the earliest evidence of human carnivory. Pott says these novel Oldowan helped hominins adjust to the impressive array of environments now that their diet included, quote, everything that any animal could eat in African environments in a very, very dynamic world of environmental change, end quote. Some researchers even suggest that this new diet contributed to an increase in human brain size. Yet, perhaps equally important, the Kenjira stone evokes a period of transition from an itinerant life to one more rooted in a particular place. The first generations to pioneer these tools treated Kenjira South as their headquarters. Further excavation has revealed that these early humans made repeated visits to Kenjira South over hundreds to thousands of years. Brianna Popbinner, a paleoanthropologist with a Smithsonian Human Origins program, once wrote, collecting quartz-sized rocks on their forays into surrounding areas, these ancestors returned to Kenjira South over and over to make more tools, to gather, to eat, to live. There is this hint that this place is the beginning of a sense of home for early humans, Pott says. Here's a short story called High Expectations, Heroes of the Wild, photographed by Gretchen K. Stewart. and written by Maddie Bender. There's a picture here of what you would could be forgiven for guessing that it's a dog, but it's, I guess it's not. The Cascade Red Fox, which isn't always red in this case. It's black with little silver tips on the end of its fur. Does not hibernate. Along with pocket gophers, veils, birds, and snowshoe hares, it eats fruits and insects. A mountain range in the Pacific Northwest is a last bastion for a unique canine. A rare red fox is clinging to life in Washington State, up in the Cascade Mountains. It's smaller than its lowland cousins, its feet are furrier, and it primarily eats pocket gophers. Researchers believe this alpine subspecies split from common red foxes during a past ice age and has remained genetically distinct because of its geographic isolation. A fox that's down around Seattle and a Cascade red fox up on Mount Rainier were separated by almost 500,000 years of evolution, says Jocelyn Atkins, a biologist and the founder of the Cascades Carnivore Project. The nonprofit research group is grappling with a key question: how many of the foxes are left? When a species is really rare, it's very helpful to count them, but also extremely difficult, Atkins says. In the Southern Cascades, the subspecies only known habitat, researchers estimate there are effectively fewer than 20 breeding foxes. One unusual source of information about the animal is social media. Researchers study photos of Cascade foxes posted by visitors to Mount Rainier National Park. Another source is traditional knowledge. A member of the Skokomish Indian Nation named Alisa Smith Woodruff, or it has their indigenous language name, which I won't try to pronounce, but I'll spell it for you. Y-A-Y-I-A-Y-L-I-C-A. That's Alisha's indigenous language name. Has scoured Northwest tribes' story work, fictional tales informed by fact for reference to the Cascade fox. In one story, a fox is outsmarted by a flock of snipe that would have otherwise become lunch. Pinpointing such tales can yield clues to the animal's past whereabouts. As far as researchers can tell, the Cascade fox's current range maybe half of what it once was. Competing species and park visitors who interact with the foxes have all factored into the declining numbers. In June, state officials were set to designate the Cascade fox as threatened, a classification that requires the government to fund conservation measures in the peaks the animals call home. My hope is that there will be new interest, and with it financial support, to understand what threatens the Cascade fox, says Atkins. Then officials, advocates, and even Instagram-loving humans can better understand the distinctive animal and its habitat. And it is really cute. I want to reach out and pet him, but I can't. Up next, Ask Smithsonian. You've got questions, we've got experts. I've heard that purple was called the royal color because purple dye used to be scarce. Why didn't people just combine blue and red? Dan Warnock of Baker City, Oregon asks. Many purples in historic fabrics are, in fact, the result of coloring a fabric with a blue dye, like indigo or woad, and a red dye, like madder, M-A-D-D-E-R. But the Tyrrhenian purple associated with royalty, believed to have originated in Phoenicia, modern Lebanon, as early as 1200 B.C., was made by extracting mucus from snails found along the Mediterranean Sea through an expensive, labor-intensive process. Ancient writings suggest this dye was desirable not only for its brilliant hue, but also for its ability to stay colorfast over time. Similar sea snails are found across the world in some cultures, like the Mixtec weavers in Oaxaca, Mexico, still use them for dyes today. Jennifer Coleman Brockie, head librarian of the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum, answered that. Are there any invasive species that have actually improved the U.S. ecosystems? Frank Gregorio, Manassas, Virginia, asks. The short answer is no, since invasive species are by definition species that threaten the native ecosystem. Many arrive accidentally, stowing away in containers or escaping gardens. Sometimes non-native species are introduced with good intentions, for instance, to help prevent soil erosion or to keep other non-native species under control. But any time a non-native species is introduced to an ecosystem, there's a risk that the newcomer will replace local species by attacking or outcompeting them. The best approach is to avoid introducing them altogether. Gary Krupnik, head of the Plant Conservation Unit, National Museum of Natural History. How did the body of a violin get its shape? Now, there's somebody that's been thinking. Edwin Anderson, Glendora, California, asks. Bowed instruments have existed for more than 1,000 years, but early examples like those found in Arab lands had only a few strings and lacked a narrow waist. By the 1400s, instrument makers in Spain were building viola da gambas with as many as 7 strings. These instruments were built with narrow waist so musicians could bow the top and bottom strings without hitting the sides. It's generally accepted that Andrea Amati in Cremona, Italy, built the first 4-string violin in the 16th century, following the general shape of the viola da gamba. The violin family, including violin, viola, and cello, were refined by his grandsons, Niccolo Amati, and Niccolo's followers, including Antonio Stradivari. Gary Strum, Curator Emeritus, National Museum of American History, gave us that explanation. Very good. And the last one, we once believed metamorphosis completely. Oh, let me get to the question first. Does the brain of a butterfly or moth retain memories from when it was a caterpillar? Philip Grant, Pasadena, California. We once believed metamorphosis completely dissolved the caterpillar and rearranged its components. But in a study published in 2008, caterpillars were trained to associate the smell of ethyl acetate with mild electrical shock. Emerging adults showed a similar aversion to the smell of ethyl acetate without a shock, as they did as larvae when paired with the shock, suggesting that some synaptic pathways had been retained. So while adult moths and butterflies probably don't remember the details of what it was like to be a caterpillar, certain associative memories can persist into adulthood. Floyd Shockley, Entomology Collections Manager, National Museum of Natural History, answered that question. And to fill out our time, I'm going back to the front of the Smithsonian under discussion. And these two are questions from readers. Artifact ownership. Returning ill-collected artifacts to their home of origin is commendable, referring to the ethical collecting in the June 22. As a part of the return, I hope the Smithsonian will use advanced techniques to capture information about each piece. Such historical and cultural treasures can be lost again to wars, pillaging and theft, says Kip Louise McVeigh. A deeper meaning, reading the real Pinocchio and learning the truth behind the story, brings it in line with other fairy tales. Most were originally written as allegories for political or social causes. They have an underlying message that gets garbled over time. I am glad to learn of another meaning of this story, since I have long felt that is one of the darker ones. Linda DeVore, Simpsonville, South Carolina. From big screen to world stage, I had no idea that Shirley Temple Black was a pioneer in the environmental movement. She was a strong woman who really made a difference. I don't think people took her seriously at first, but she showed them she wasn't a little tap-dancing four-year-old anymore. That's from Paul Wade, W-A-I-D, Merrill. We've gotten through the whole magazine, the July-August edition, over these 5 Wednesdays. I'm going to take a moment to remind you that we have a program called Salute a Veteran Every Day that runs once a month. And our last one was a blind member who was a veteran, and I don't want to say her name because I might mess it up, but Travon was her first name. Anyway, we enjoy that, and we are still looking for other blind and print impaired veterans who may like to be on the program. And as the host of that, I can tell you that many people are quite reticent to volunteer, but once they do it and it's over, they say, hey, that was fun. And it's always fun for me and interesting, I hope, for you. So if you want to be interviewed or you want to nudge somebody else who's blind or print impaired to get interviewed and they're a veteran, our number, which we give at the end of every program, is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And now we get to our usual outro for Smithsonian, although we still have some time. Let's see, we've got about a minute left. We've run out of time, my script says. Not quite, on this episode of Smithsonian. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. Be sure and listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And there's a whole host of programs on there for you to listen to. If you have any comments or questions, please call us. Again, that number is what? 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. It's been my pleasure and honor to read for you.